Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
The average person probably doesn't know the name of too many architects. It's not usually something that easily comes to mind, unless you're an architecture or history buff, or maybe you just watch the Brady Bunch. But there is one name that most will recognize: Frank Lloyd Wright. He has long been regarded as one of the most brilliant minds in American architecture, and most of us are familiar with some of his famous designs, like Falling Water in Pennsylvania, or the Ennis House in Los Angeles, which served as a stand-in in the Vincent Price movie, The House on Haunted Hill, and the prairie-style homes that he invented, which other designers would turn into that most American of home styles, the ranch house. The homes and buildings that Wright designed were stunning, unique, and original, and those that remain stand as physical reminders of his genius. One of those remaining creations was Taliesin, a home and studio in Spring Green, Wisconsin, that was built to be a hideaway for Wright and his mistress. But on August 15, 1914, Taliesin became a scene of horror when a grisly murder spree claimed the lives of Wright's mistress, two of her children, and four others who worked at the estate. It was a terrible event that also, some claim, created a haunting that endures to this day. Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. And welcome to Season 8, Home, which is written and performed by Troy Taylor. Hey, that's me. And produced and co-hosted by Cody Back. This season, we're on a cross-country trip in search of America's murder houses, relics of time and crimes gone by. We're going behind the locked doors of both famous and little-known places where murder and violence have left lingering ghosts behind. In this episode, we'll revisit a horrific murder that happened behind the doors of one of America's most unusual homes and claim the life of a woman who was loved by America's greatest architect of the time. It was a shocking end to a story that had already scandalized the country, and one that still lingers today as a reminder of what happened on that terrible August afternoon. He was a narcissist and control freak, house builder and home wrecker, curmudgeon and adulterer who led a life of scandal, debt, and even murder. But along the way, Frank Lloyd Wright designed the most innovative buildings of 20th century America. Open kitchens, homes built over waterfalls, sprawling structures that were one with nature, all of them came from his ability to dream in three dimensions and put those dreams to paper. His entire life was one of extremes, or perhaps I should say his two lives. One he created and one he lived, but both were too strange and hard to believe to make up, and yet both were filled with lies. Early in his life, Wright shaved 2 years off his age and changed his middle name from Lincoln to Lloyd to honor his mother's Welsh heritage. It was his mother who pushed him toward becoming an architect, filling the walls of his childhood room in Wisconsin with engravings of English castles. She had abandoned Frank's musician father soon after the boy was born, but with no man in his life, she became worried he might become effeminate. So she sent him to work on her brother's farm to work the land and toughen up. Despite his mother's fear, Wright was rarely without a woman. His first wife, Catherine, was tall, rich, and when they met, she was 16 and he was 20. They married 2 years later, and she gave him 4 sons and 2 daughters. Though he worked at one of Chicago's top architectural firms, he spent lavishly moonlighting so he could make ends meet. He filled one of the rooms of his house with chandeliers, an Arabian Nights mural, and a balcony for theatrical performances. And that was just the children's playroom. He became renowned for his bungalows and churches, but as one newspaper noted in 1910, he had created some, quote, occasional freakish styles, such as a residence built around a large tree and another without windows. The article also noted that Wright designed his wife's gowns and allowed his children to pick their own names at the age of 6. If that makes it clear to you that Wright wasn't cut out for ordinary fatherhood, well, then you're right. He eventually abandoned his projects, his wife, and his kids, and ran off with a client's wife. And that's where the story of Taliesin actually begins. In 1903, Wright was living in Oak Park, Illinois, with Catherine and their children. As a side project, he was designing a house for an electrical engineer named Edwin Cheney. It was then that Wright met Cheney's wife, Martha, and the two of them fell in love. Now, it should be clear she was no easily influenced housewife. Martha Borthwick Cheney was an educated woman with both a bachelor's degree and a master's degree from the University of Michigan. She later worked as a librarian in Port Huron, Michigan, and gained attention for translating the works of Swedish thinker and writer Ellen Key, who she admired. In 1899, Martha married Edwin, and they had 2 children together, John in 1902 and Martha in 1905. They also adopted Martha's niece, Jessie Pitkin, after Martha's sister, Jessie Octavia, died in childbirth in 1901. It had been Catherine Wright who met Martha first. Both were members of a philanthropic women's group, and the two couples soon became close friends. Edwin eventually commissioned Wright to design a new home for the Cheney family, but as the project progressed, it became clear to everyone in the community, including Edwin and Catherine, that Frank and Martha had grown a bit too close. The affair turned into a massive public scandal, even getting attention from the national media, thanks to Wright's growing popularity. In 1909, when the couple decided to leave their spouses and start a new life together, they tried to avoid the press by separately traveling to different destinations in Europe and then meeting secretly in Florence, Italy. But reporters got wind of this and berated the couple in print. A few editors even demanded that Wright be arrested for immorality. But even in 1909, that wasn't really a thing. I mean, come on, right or wrong, these two were certainly not the first people to leave their spouses for someone else. Reporters, some things just never change. Anyway, Wright and Martha lived together in sin, of course, in Europe for a year. Wright studied local architecture during that time and began sketching ideas for a new studio, since he couldn't exactly go back to Oak Park. During that year away, Edwin granted Martha a divorce, but Catherine refused to do so. She told reporters that she believed her husband would eventually come to his senses and return to his family. There would be no divorce, she said. In April 1911, Wright's mother purchased land for him near her family's property outside of Spring Green, Wisconsin. He filed the deeds in her name, hoping the press wouldn't get wind of Wright's purchase. During this time, Martha was in the United States, spending time with her children and finishing the paperwork for her divorce. When that was completed, she joined Wright in Spring Green, where construction had already begun on the new home and studio where he believed the couple could live out of the public eye. The house quickly rose on a hill that Wright had loved when he stayed with his uncle as a boy, and he called it Taliesin, which was Welsh for shining brow. But that's not what the locals and the press called it. They dubbed the place the Love Castle. The community was not exactly welcoming of their new neighbors. The editor of the Spring Green newspaper condemned Wright for bringing scandal to his town. The couple was criticized by church ministers and even the superintendent of the community schools. When sharp tongues, disapproving looks, and even threats failed to convince the couple to leave Spring Green, townspeople called on the sheriff to arrest Wright. But neither Wright nor Martha was concerned about standard conventions or what the outside world thought about their relationship, and really there was nothing the sheriff could do about it. Despite criticism, the couple lived and worked at Taliesin for several years. The public opinion against them did become burdensome over time, since the negative publicity that surrounded their affair made it difficult for Wright to find work. In fact, his next notable project, the Midway Gardens outside Chicago, didn't come along until 1913. Meanwhile, Martha was translating four more of Ellen Key's books and spending time with her children. Edwin had maintained custody of John and Martha, but they did often come to visit. Wright's studio stayed busy with draftsmen and designers coming and going each day, and the couple was surrounded by the constant bustle of workmen, gardeners, and service staff. Life seemed good at Taliesin for the next several years. But in 1914, the Love Castle would become a slaughterhouse. In the summer of 1914, Wright had hired a new chef that had been recommended to him by John Vogelsong Jr., the caterer at the Midway Gardens project that Wright was still working on. The chef was an immigrant from Barbados named Julian Carlton, and Vogelsong's parents had previously hired Carlton and his wife Gertrude to work in their Chicago home. Carlton had been an excellent employee until he wasn't. Toward the middle of summer, he became increasingly paranoid and began getting into arguments with other staff members. When someone spotted Carlton standing at his window at night with a large knife in his hands, they told Wright about it. He'd already reached his limit with Carlton after several altercations between the chef and one of his draftsmen, Emil Brodel, in the days leading up to this unnerving report. Wright placed an ad for a new chef and informed Carlton that his last day would be August 15th. Convinced that Emil Brodel was behind his firing, Carlton told him that he planned to get him and would be waiting for his chance. On the afternoon of August 15th, Wright was in Chicago at the Midway Gardens, and Martha's children, Martha, who was now 8, and John, who was 11, were visiting from Illinois. When lunchtime came, Martha and the children sat down to wait for it to be served on a porch in the residential wing of the house. In the main dining room, which was at the opposite end of a 25-foot-long corridor, Wright's draftsmen and other workers gathered around the table where Carlton served their usual noontime meal. A few moments later, he entered the room with a tray of soup bowls. He silently placed a bowl in front of each man and quickly left. Distracted by their meal, the men didn't notice that when Carlton left the dining room, he locked the door behind him. He returned to the kitchen, where he was supposed to pick up a separate tray that held soup for Martha and the two children. Before he left the kitchen, he told his wife Gertrude to go home. He would handle the rest of the lunch service that day. Carlton turned and left without the soup. Instead of a tray, he had something else in his hand, a hatchet that he had taken from the gardening shed. As soon as he emerged from the door onto the porch, Carlton swung the hatchet and struck Martha in the head. The blade shattered her skull, killing her instantly. Her body crashed forward onto the table. Before John could cry out, Carlton hit him too. The hatchet cleaved open his skull. Blood sprayed the table and walls as the boy fell from his chair. Little Martha tried to scream, but her cries came out as only panicked yelps. She jumped out of her chair, dashed down the steps, and tried to escape across the lawn. But she wasn't fast enough. Carlton caught up to her in the courtyard and struck her down. Hacked apart by the blade, the little girl bled to death on the ground. Carlton then returned to the dining room where the men were eating. A 19-year-old draftsman named Herbert Fritz was the first to notice what happened next. He heard what he said sounded like the swish of water, and then saw some kind of liquid flowing under the door. It spread out across the floor, and then he realized from the smell and the fumes, it was gasoline. As the workmen scrambled to their feet, the room suddenly burst into flames. Herbert threw himself against the door, but it wouldn't open. With his clothing burning and his hair on fire, Herbert smashed through the window near where he'd been sitting and rolled on the ground to try to put out the flames. When he looked back, he saw the house was burning and he saw Julian Carlton swinging a hatchet at those trapped in the inferno of the dining room. Carlton managed to kill his nemesis, Emil Brodell, foreman Thomas Bunker, a gardener named David Lindblom, and Ernest Weston, the 13-year-old son of Wright's carpenter, William Weston, who managed to escape from the house. Out on the lawn, Weston found Herbert Fritz and sent the young man to call for help. Weston stayed behind to try to put out the fire with several local farmers who soon arrived to lend a hand. Herbert ran a half mile to the nearest house to telephone for help. A fire crew hurried to the house while a minister and relative of Wright's, Jenkins Lloyd Jones, along with county deputies, assembled a posse to track down Carlton. They didn't have to look far. Carlton was found hiding inside the house, waiting out the blaze in a fireproof furnace room. He was barely conscious when he was found, having swallowed a vial of acid so he could commit suicide if the heat from the fire became unbearable, or if he was caught, whichever came first. Despite his condition, he was taken into custody and locked up in the Dodgeville jail, where doctors treated his condition. His throat and stomach turned out to be too badly damaged, though, and Carlton died 7 weeks later of starvation before he could stand trial. He never explained the reason for the attack. His wife Gertrude said that he'd become very strange and nervous in the weeks leading up to the attack, even keeping that hatchet next to their bed at night. Rumors claimed that Carlton had been harassed by the other staff members at Taliesin, but no evidence of this was found. But even if he'd had disagreements with Wright's staff and other workmen, why would he kill Martha and the children? Some believe that perhaps he thought Martha had something to do with him losing his job, but this seems unlikely. The motive for their murder remains a mystery. When word reached Chicago about the massacre at Taliesin, Wright and Edwin Cheney rushed to Spring Green by train, arriving to find what Wright later described as a devastating scene of horror. Cheney claimed the mutilated bodies of his children and left, leaving his former friend to deal with the aftermath of the horror on his own. In his grief, Wright refused to let the undertaker touch Martha's body. Instead, he had his own carpenters build a simple wooden box for her. There was no funeral service. The coffin was placed on a plain farm wagon covered with flowers and drawn by two horses. Wright's son John and two of his cousins helped him to lower Martha's remains in a hole that had been dug in a little cemetery behind his mother's family's chapel. Wright filled Martha's grave himself and then left it unmarked because he couldn't bear to be reminded of the loss. Why mark the spot where desolation ended and began? He asked. Wright was alone, but grieving or not, he wouldn't stay that way for long. After hearing about the tragedy, an artist named Miriam Knoll sent a condolence letter to Wright, and within 2 weeks, they became involved. When Catherine, his first wife, finally granted him a divorce in 1922, he waited the required year and then married Miriam. In addition to starting over with his love life, Wright also resurrected Taliesin, much of which had been destroyed by the fire. By the end of the year, it had mostly been rebuilt, even though it nearly burned again in 1925, this time because of an electrical surge through the newly installed telephone line. It occurred during a storm. He rebuilt it again, and it still stands today. But prior to that second fire, Wright and Miriam shared the home, just as he and Martha had. But this relationship was not so easy. Miriam had a morphine addiction, which made things rocky, to say the least. Unable to be around each other, Miriam moved out in the spring of 1924. And a few months later, Wright met future wife number three, Russian dancer Olga Ivanova Milanov-Hinzenberg, who Wright thankfully nicknamed Oglavana, so I don't have to butcher any more Russian and get complaints from listeners. Wright met the young woman who was, by the way, 32 years younger than he was, when the Petrograd Ballet played in Chicago, and she soon moved to Taliesin. The following year, Miriam filed for divorce, claiming that Wright was cruel and had deserted her. Among her demands of the divorce was ownership of Taliesin, which Wright naturally refused. She eventually tried to take the house by force, but never got past the front gates. The divorce was finalized in 1927, the same year that Miriam was arrested in Madison, Wisconsin, in the dining room of the Hotel Lorraine for sending an obscene letter to Wright. It should also be added that during their conflict over the divorce, Miriam even tried to get Wright charged with violation of the Mann Act for transporting a woman across state lines for immoral purposes. The woman she listed in the complaint? Yeah, it was herself. Okay. While the divorce was still pending, Wright and Oglavana had a daughter, Iovana, and married in 1928. 4 years later, they came up with a genius way to pay the bills, and they founded the Taliesin Fellowship, where for the next 30 years, wannabe architects labored on Wright's homes for nothing. They not only worked in the drafting rooms, but cooked, cleaned, and paid tuition for it. It was a brilliant scheme because by then, Wright was nearly broke after years of expensive living. But even so, his star continued to rise, and work began on Taliesin West, near Scottsdale, Arizona, in 1937. It became the winter home for the family and Wright's students in a place that he and Oglavana called their idea of heaven. Because there were so many men and so few women at Taliesin West, the Wrights dictated the students' sex lives, rotating the women as needed. On the plus side, though, many young gay men found the compound a safe place during those homophobic times. Wright continued to be a controversial figure. His designs often advanced technology because of what was needed to support them, but on the other hand, he didn't care that some of them leaked. When a client complained that water was falling on his desk, Wright told him to move the desk. He was also a man of many contradictions. He designed a school for African-American children in the South, but yet could be openly racist. Many of his clients were Jewish, and yet he agreed with those who believed America's entry into World War II was engineered by Jews. You see, he was an equal opportunity hater, and his long list of imbeciles made no distinctions about race or ethnicity. He could be scathing to rivals, living or dead, and he never passed a mirror that he didn't admire himself in. His regard for himself was monumental, and he once identified himself in court as, quote, the world's greatest living architect. When Oglevana criticized him for being so immodest, he replied, well, you forget, I was under oath. Wright was a publicity hound, but one who deserved the fame he achieved. He was a genius, even if he knew it. Wright died at Taliesin West in 1959. He was 92 years old, and according to his wishes, his remains were taken back to Wisconsin to be buried next to Martha, who had been killed so many years before. Her gravestone, by the way, was eventually marked. But even in death, Wright couldn't choose between his wives. After Oglevana's death in 1985, his body was exhumed, cremated, and their ashes were scattered together at Taliesin in Arizona, the place the couple had always considered to be their idea of heaven. Today, Taliesin in Wisconsin stands as a historic site and preserved relic of Frank Lloyd Wright's glory days. It's open for tours and staffed by employees and volunteers who greet visitors and can talk at length about the house and Wright's storied career. They are less inclined to talk about the murders that happened here in 1914 and even less interested in talking about the stories of lingering ghostly activity that's been reported here for the last 100 odd years. But yet the stories continue to be told, despite their lack of official interest. In the hours after the attack, while the house was still smoldering, rescues carried the dead, dying, and badly burned victims to the cottage up the hill called Tanya Dairy, where Wright's sister lived. It is in and around this cottage where strange events have been reported over the decades. Witnesses have reported seeing lights turning on and off, windows opening and closing by themselves, and hearing slamming doors, footsteps, and the voices of children. They've also sensed the phantom smells of smoke and gasoline. Staff members say they've often closed the cottage for the night, only to return the following day to find the door unlocked and standing open. Inside of Taliesin itself, the ghost of Martha Borthwick has frequently been encountered, usually wearing a long white dress. Her presence isn't described as being frightening, but she does seem restless and distraught. Outside the residential part of the house, steps away from the porch where Martha and her children had waited for lunch on that fateful day, the ghost of a little girl has been encountered in the nearby courtyard. It was at this place where little Martha was chased down and killed by Julian Carlton, her life cut short by his hatchet. It seems her terror and confusion has caused her to stay behind at the site of her death, still running from her killer over and over again. The events of the past are still very much a part of the present at Taliesin, as Martha, her children, and the other victims of the massacre refused to leave the house where their lives came to an end more than a century ago. There's more show to come, so enjoy these delightful messages from our sponsors.
Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to BadlandsRanch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to BadlandsRanch.com/save50 today.
Connection is a healthy and essential aspect of our daily lives. From a warm hug after a hard day to kind words just when we need them, these gentle moments give us an understanding of life's true meaning. But when the ability to connect is interrupted by the hustle of daily life and to-do lists pile up next to the worry of who needs school supplies, sometimes making decisions about our health and the well-being of our loved ones can take a back seat. When it comes to those we care for, vaccines are one of the greatest public health success stories, and along with other measures, are one way to help prevent certain diseases. At Merck, we envision communities where families, healthcare providers, local organizations, and advocates work together. Health equity happens when every person, regardless of age and ethnicity, in every community, has fair access to healthcare, including the vaccines they need. For more information, please visit whyvaccines.com.
I just ate some cookies, so
okay. get some milk and get
something. All right. Welcome back to American Hauntings, and thanks to all who've joined us for episode number 14 of our latest season. My name is Troy Taylor. I'm the creator of American Hauntings, and I wrote and narrated this episode while waiting for my lunch to be delivered. I'm wondering where that new guy is. Anyway, this episode was edited and produced by my co-host, Cody Beck.
You're waiting for your lunch, huh?
Yeah, I served on a tray. I'm soup. I heard it's coming.
Yeah. I was actually told I should go home while you guys are eating lunch.
Okay, then. So there you go.
Yeah, I guess I'm getting out of this one. but we'll have plenty of time to make more jokes about that. But before we do that, what's going on, man?
Well, it's the tail end of summer now, I guess you would say. It's almost over, or it might as well be over, at least around here. It's pretty much fall because our summer events are pretty much over, and now we are gearing up for fall. All of our dinner and spirits tours and events are filling up. So if you don't make decisions about what you want to do this fall, you're going to run out of options pretty quick. So we'll send everybody over to dinnerandspirits.com and join us for all kinds of stuff we've got coming up. So we had a busy weekend with a lot of things and lots more coming. So our tours in Chicago, Decatur, they're already on sale for the season. Our Alton tours just went on sale yesterday, August 12th. So there's a little time on those, but not a whole lot. And if the fall tours are anything like the summer tours, they're going to fill up. I don't think we've ever had every single summer tour sell out before the way they have this year.
Nice.
I don't know why, but I'm glad. And, I shouldn't say I don't know why. We've got good guides doing good stuff, I think. So, but you could check that out at altonhauntings.com. And then don't forget, we've also added several brand new things to the American Oddities Museum over the past couple of weeks. I got some other stuff coming in before Labor Day. So if you're in town, stop by. We're open every single weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, 12 to 5. And I think I can't remember the last thing I've had as much fun doing as I have had doing this museum.
Nice.
It's been a blast. I mean, lifelong kind of goal to have something like this. So it's been a lot of fun.
Well, that's awesome.
Yeah. So Patreon. Patreon members. I know. I think we've got some new people.
We've got some new people. Yeah.
So yeah. Shout out to.
Yeah. I want to give a quick shout out. Thank you so much for subscribing to the show. To Hannah, Kari, Trink, Jamie, Mindy, Melody, Aaron, David, and Brett.
Yeah.
People seem to be really enjoying that.
Yeah. Well, we've got three full seasons. It's our alternate podcast. People can binge it. We're getting deep into season four, getting closer toward the end. So those shows are posted every other week. So that means that our supporters get a new show every week. No waiting. So if you want to check it out, and we hope you will, because it has been I think every season has been fun, but this one I've really had a good time with. But you can check it out at patreon.com/AmericanHauntings. So thanks to everybody who is joining us and leaving comments on the new posts and things. So
absolutely. Cool. Well, we got a listener review I wanted to call out real quick.
Oh, okay.
This one comes to us from Always Carolina 1984, titled Love the Show. It says, I love y'all's show. I stumbled on it by accident, which is, you know, the best way to find it. I saw Troy in a documentary on Titanic. I love his book Without a Trace, and I'm looking forward to reading part two. I love listening to the story and then listening to the discussion. Most podcasts just tell the story, and that's the end. I someday would love to come to an event of yours. I live in Indiana, so I'm close. Maybe someday I'll make it. Love you guys. Well, thank you so much. That's awesome.
The only thing mysterious about that review was I did a documentary about the Titanic.
Who knows?
I don't know. I don't remember. It's possible, though.
They might have. Maybe they just spliced you in from something else.
Maybe. I don't know. That's cool. So, yeah, you just and people hit you with that stuff. Sometimes they'll tell me, oh, I saw you on something. I go, huh? Cool.
Interesting.
I did not remember that, but all right. So,
jeez. Yeah. I wonder how many credits you actually would have on IMDb or something. I know. If there were somebody really went through. In fact,
they finally, I think somebody finally took my undercover brother off there. You know, it was on there for years.
Yeah.
That is not the same Troy Taylor. He is a music producer, but I cherished that credit, but somebody eventually caught up.
Damn.
It was not actually me. So,
oh, that's unfortunate. Yeah. I mean, that would probably ruin my day. Okay, Frank Lloyd Wright.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah. That he was such an interesting character.
Well, I knew he was an interesting character. I didn't know everything about how interesting he was, but I definitely didn't know about the story with the family or the mistress and all that.
Yeah.
That's pretty terrible.
Yeah. Oh, it's an awful story. It almost seems to fit. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, as far as just every other wild thing in his life, I mean, you know, this is a guy who, you know, always said that he was, you know, so notorious and famous, but deserved every bit of it. I mean, he was a genius, but I think a kind of a mad genius, mm-hmm. you know, as well, because he knew it. That's for sure. He was well aware of his genius and
right.
made sure that everyone else was well aware of it too, in kind of a Thomas Edison kind of way. I just, the difference I think between say someone like Edison and Frank Lloyd Wright was that Edison really profited a lot off other people's work. Mm-hmm. You know, guys that worked for him in his labs that invented a lot of stuff. And then it just became, you know, I don't think he necessarily went around and said, I invented this, but his company did. And that's how began. He was always suing people and all kinds of stuff. And I think with Wright, you know, he was definitely an original thinker. I mean, I think he designed this stuff and I think that sometimes the crazier, the better. I don't know how, if you've ever visited many of his, you know, creations.
Yeah. I've seen a few.
Yeah. I was a few years ago, I guess just maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I went to two of his houses in Pennsylvania. One was, I mean, they're just so weird. The kitchens are tiny. They're like cramped little kitchens. And then there'll be a living room that's 50 feet long, you know, because it was not, these were the things he considered unimportant, like the kitchen, you know, just tuck it out of the way because it's ugly, you know, and give a big space to something else. But Falling Water is, while fascinating, is the weirdest. I don't know why you would want a waterfall running through the middle of your house. I mean, I get it. You want to be one with nature, but I would think it would be so humid in there that, you know, you would never, you know, all your furniture would be moldy. You know, it's just weird. But it's beautiful and it's genius. And the way that it all worked was genius. But, Yeah, I just think this, you know, he really was an odd character. You know, he really was.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm checking out this Falling Water. I've heard about it. I'm sure I've seen it before, but it's bizarre.
Yeah. Probably one. I think that's probably one of those most famous.
Yeah.
There is a house in Springfield, Illinois.
I went there. It's a museum
yeah.
now.
Yeah. It's very cool. You know, and it's got a very cool history behind it too. You know, Dana Thomas. That Thomas was a book mm-hmm. publisher who bought it later, but Susan Lawrence Dana owned it originally, and she was a spiritualist and did seances in the house and, you know, and all kinds of stuff. And so that's an interesting place. It's, I think, a little bit more mainstream than some of the others, mm-hmm. you know, because it was pretty early on, you know, early 1900s. And he was really just starting with the prairie idea of the prairie homes with the, you know, which eventually would morph into ranch houses, essentially the sprawling long flat instead of the up and down houses, you know, of the Victorian era. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, he's a fascinating guy, but didn't really, you know, kind of did whatever he felt like doing. I mean, that kind of became the, you know, the plan of his life is just do whatever you want, and didn't really matter about the collateral damage. You know, his kids mm-hmm. really have a lot of interest in his kids. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, you know, let them name themselves when they turn six,
yeah,
you know, and things like that. And really didn't take into a lot of consideration what was going to happen with all those kids after he, you know, took off with, you know, his best friend, or maybe not best friend, but good friend's wife,
yeah,
who was also friends with his wife. Uh-huh. And they just decided that they were meant to be together, and off they went, which, I mean, you know, that's not an uncommon story, but it was somewhat uncommon back then, mm-hmm. you know, in, you know, 1909, that just wasn't one of those things that most people did.
Not that I would want it, that I'd want anything bad to happen to the man or whatever, but it definitely sucks that, like, he nothing happened. He didn't get hit with an axe or
yeah, nothing happened to him. No, it's and nothing really happened to him, and he quickly moved on.
Yeah,
when it was over. But you know, the story behind the way that, I don't know, people looked at it a lot differently, and I think even today, you know, we still have this tendency to look at, you know, you see celebrities and things that meet somebody on a movie set and then take off and abandon their wife and take off with somebody new. And you see that kind of stuff all the time, and people will criticize it. But then yeah, I don't think it was quite like it was back then, you know, mm-hmm. the, you know, wanting to run them out of town and have them arrested and, you know, and all right. kinds of stuff. But really, I think that this murder became this really tragic event in his life. I mean, he had been dealing with the fact that he wasn't getting work, and that they were being constantly criticized and gossiped about and everything. But then I think that the murder just really were murders.
Yeah.
But mostly it was, I think, probably Martha that was he was more upset by than anything, you know. But he had built this, you know, beautiful house in the middle of, you know, which should have been a crime-free area in Spring Green, Wisconsin, and, you know, moved in and was using it as his headquarters, really, so to speak. They were doing all the designs there and traveling back and forth to Chicago to work on the Midway Gardens and things. And, you know, he made the mistake of just hiring the wrong guy.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that, you know, Julian Carlton had obviously had some issues before this that no one knew about. Mm-hmm. I always wondered about, you know, the fact that he was given a reference to be a chef by a guy who handled the catering at the Midway Gardens project and said that this guy had worked for his parents. But my question is if he was such a great chef, why was he no longer working for that sure. guy's parents?
Right.
I think I would have asked that. And maybe instead of just hiring him on the spot, because it makes me think there might have been something more to his background than before this, you know. And I don't think that I think this guy kind of cooked up in his head that, you know, all of these guys working for Wright were, you know, these racists who were bullying him and everything. I think it really had a lot more to do with him just being kind of nuts, you know.
Yeah, really. Yeah. If you're gonna check somebody's references, like, you can't half-assed. Like, what's the point of even checking if you're not really going to check?
I guess, I don't know. Maybe things just seemed safer then. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, obviously it turned out bad. Why he killed Martha and the kids, though, that I don't get. I mean, other than he was crazy. I mean, if it was just revenge against Emil Brodel, who he got his revenge on him, but he also got his revenge on all those guys and set the house on fire.
Yeah.
I mean, this is for being picked on. This seems extreme to me. You know, murders of two little kids and a woman, and then tries to kill the entire staff and burn down the house. Yeah, that's definitely taking things to the next level.
That's a lot of collateral damage. Yeah, and exactly. And it's also not just, okay, so wants to kill his nemesis or whatever, that's fine. But then to brutally murder children, especially in that way.
Oh, like, God, I know, with the hatchet.
Yeah, it's like, what the hell?
Chase that little girl across the yard and, oh, my God. Yeah, it's horrible. It's really horrible. Ugh. And then, you know, and then one of the guys there, one of the people he kills in the dining room is just happens to be the, you know, one guy, the carpenter's son, who's like 13, who's just there visiting, you know, is hanging out with dad having lunch and kills the kid. Dad gets away and he kills the rest of them. It's just horrible. I mean, it's just really horrible.
You just never, life can change on a dime, I guess.
Yeah, I guess. And one thing I couldn't find, which interested me, is when we reached Chicago about the murders and the fire, is that both Wright and Edwin Cheney rushed to Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't find anything that said one way or the other, but I was curious if they rode together on the train.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know why. I just, some reason that just stuck in my head. And I thought, well, that would be an awkward trip. Mm-hmm. I mean, not only are you upset, you know, about what has happened and you know you're going to something horrible, but you're also riding with the guy who, you know, stole your wife.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I'd like to think they rode in separate cars, even if they were on the same train. But I don't know. I wondered about that. But
yeah,
just curiosity.
Yeah. What would that conversation even be?
That's a good question. I have absolutely no idea. Although I would think it might be something like, you know, this is your fault.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you lured her away. My kids are up here visiting. Now she's dead, and so are my kids. You know, so because he took the kids' bodies and went straight home.
Yeah.
Did not hang around for the, you know, the after effects and festivities. I guess I wouldn't call them festivities, but the lack of funeral services that followed. So
yeah, and the lack of what lack of tombstones, lack of
everything, pretty much. I mean, he dug the hole himself. Well, his son and a carpenter helped him, but you know, they built the box and he filled in the hole by himself and, you know, and then didn't mark the grave because, well, you know, why mark the spot where desolation ended and began, you know, but, you know, later it would get marked, but it wasn't marked at the time.
So that could have given him some inspiration. I wonder, it's like this, the first Frank Lloyd Wright designer coffin, you know?
Oh yeah. Right. There you go. The prairie style casket, you know?
Yes.
But well, and I'm surprised that maybe that didn't, you know, didn't cross his mind, because by the end of the year, he was already hooked up with somebody else who turned out to be a major train wreck. With a morphine addiction and all kinds of things that she, you know, when they decided to get a divorce, she started, you know, threatening him and sending him threatening and obscene letters, whatever that means. I'm not even sure what that means. But I did like the part about how she tried to have him charged with the Mann Act for transporting herself across state lines. And I thought, how exactly, what, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, that was wild. But, and then didn't take long. He was still going through a divorce when he'd already gotten somebody else pregnant. So yeah, he, you know, like I said, in the beginning, his mother was afraid because he loved to draw that he might become effeminate. So I don't think there was any chance of him not liking girls. I think that ship sailed. So because I think that got him into probably more trouble than anything else, as it turned out. But whatever, you know.
Yeah, that'll
interesting
happen.
Interesting life. Interesting life.
Long life, too. Doesn't die until he's 92.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's where
outlived pretty much everybody.
So, yeah, right. Yeah. That's just funny how that works out sometimes.
Right.
But yeah, then of course there's ghost stories tied to, you know, I think it'd be if you're going to haunt someplace, like haunting one of his buildings would be kind of cool, you know, or have one of his.
Yeah. Houses. Hey, I mean, you know, except under the circumstances, you know, the people that are haunting Taliesin are not exactly, you know, people that you ghosts you want hanging around. Now, there had been stories about the house, the Dana house in Springfield, that it was Susan Dana's, I believe it was her sister, I think, that was supposed to haunt the house, who just loved the place. So that would be OK. But in this case, it's, you know, little more like they're stuck there, especially that poor little girl. You know, I mean, yes, people say they've seen Martha, and yeah, when it's an adult ghost, you kind of go, oh, well, you know, and maybe they'll move on. But then when you got a little girl who's, you know, recreating her last moments over and over again, and those last moments meant being chased across a yard and chopped with a hatchet. Yeah, that you don't. That's uncomfortable.
Yeah, I guess there's no house that's cool enough to be.
Not for that one. Not for that one. So, I could see if Wright himself wanted to stay around and haunt it, you know, because he probably, you know, liked would pick whatever house he liked the best. But so this situation, these are not ghosts you want to remain behind.
Yeah, I could see him sticking around just to be like, I'm going to make sure nobody makes any changes or,
don't make the kitchen
any bigger.
I don't want to hear that I'm not a genius at any point in time. Exactly. So when you see this house, don't complain. Don't talk about anything bad. And if your roof leaks, move your desk. So I love that story. So
I saw a couple in Chicago, I think, when we were like on an eighth grade field trip something.
Sure. Yeah. The Oak Park. Yeah. The old house, the house that he started out in Oak Park, the ones that he designed several in that neighborhood where he lived. And that's where his, you know, his offices had been at one time. But, you know, when he came back from Europe, but, you know, going back to Oak Park was kind of out of the question. So,
And then let's see. Yeah. Did the Dana House thing in Springfield. I think when I was there, I eventually ended up gifting somebody a Frank Lloyd Wright almost like coffee table book sort of thing, because it's perfect material.
Yeah,
for that.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and then I got a book about famous quotes from architects. That's like a little pocket book. It's got some neat phrases in there. I should have pulled some choice ones out of there. There's some cool stuff. There was a little bookstore like across from the Dana House. So if you're in, stuff's, you know, in various places. So if you ever get a chance to check one out and you haven't,
definitely do. Because they really range from, you know, once you start with the Prairie School stuff from the early 1900s. And I mean, you go all the way up into the, you know, the 50s and stuff. With some of this stuff gets really wild, you know.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, interesting. That's for sure. You know, some are just but they're all absolutely they're brilliant. But some are more probably a little more practical than others, I guess you would say. So, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if you can get like a normal regular house, but then like just the bathroom designed by.
Yeah. Yeah. See, that's the thing. Every time I visit one, I always think this is really cool. But there's no way I could live here.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
I mean, exactly. I like this room, but. You know, I'd have to have this room in another house because this makes no sense, you know?
Yeah. I was just recalling now that you mentioned that when I toured the Dana House, I was recovering from a meniscus surgery. And so up and down all
stairs everywhere and all short staircases because, you know, you didn't want anything to go up and down too high, you know, but just all flat and long. But here's four staircases. Wait a minute. Here's two more. Here's four. You know, here's four more steps. You know,
I forgot about how much of a nightmare that was. I was just in the rear of like every I was like, you guys go on without me. I'll be there in a second. Story doesn't really have a happy ending, but is there any loose ends we haven't tied up or talked about?
I mean, not really. I think that, you know, I think that what he left behind really speaks volumes about what he did and what he could do. And this is just kind of one of those stories that, I mean, I said it was a big moment in his life, but I don't know if it was or not. I don't know if he would consider it that way. It seems like just another blip, you know, kind of a bump in the road that he just moved on and continued to, I don't know, continue to have, I was going to say continue to have adventures, but I don't think that's the right word.
Right.
But he just kind of continued on with one more dramatic thing after another, you know? So it's a horrible, devastating thing that occurred. I don't know what kind of impact it made on his legacy. There had to have been some, because when he died, his body was brought back to Wisconsin and buried, you know, next to Martha for a while. And then he was exhumed when his next wife died and taken back to Arizona. So I don't know, man. It's an interesting story. It just is. You know?
Definitely is. All right. Well, it is now time for our Ghost Rider segment. So if you have any questions or comments about the world of the macabre, you can email us at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. Troy, I'm putting this one in here almost to shame us. I think you'll understand. This message comes to us from D. D writes, "Hi, guys. My husband and I are planning a 20th anniversary trip to New Orleans, and we thoroughly enjoy listening to New Orleans season of the podcast. I recall you saying that you had recommendations for haunted tours. I was wondering if you guys had a list that could find somewhere that and or other possible cool things to do in New Orleans. Love your podcast. Cheers, D." To shame us, I mean, because we've mentioned a tour company and things, but we've also said we'll put this together for you guys sometime. Don't worry. And
We just haven't done it yet. Because it's one of those things I think I've sent out so many times and I'm meaning to do something with it. But haunted history tours is in a nutshell. There are plenty of places to go. And if you'll send that email over to me.
Yeah.
And I will see what I can pull together from the times I've sent it out before and see what I can do here and get some stuff together. Because there are fun things to do, and we really do need to do that. So it's just one of those things I haven't gotten to yet.
Yeah, I know.
It's been a busy summer. It's been a weird, hectic summer. So
exactly. You know. But have a great time in New Orleans. You're going to love it. There's so much to see, so much to do. It's probably going to be hot depending on when you go.
Yeah. It depends on when you go, but I got to get that back on the list to do things again sometime before too long. Many summers go by. We've got to go back again. So
absolutely.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, in addition to sending us emails at Cody@AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com, you can also text us on the haunt line, which is 217-791-7859. And if I don't answer it directly, we'll definitely read it on the show. I've got a few of them here, and this one comes to us from Mary Beth in the 303. It says, "Hello, Hauntline and Troy and Cody. Mary Beth texting you live from Denver, Colorado. First off, love the podcast, the books, and all of the above. And three questions." So she's really getting a lot in for regrets. "One for Troy, one for the show, one for Cody. First, Troy, do you watch the TV show Svengoolie? If not, you totally should, since it features movies from Universal and many of the monster movies, and the host is wacky, and sometimes his blips can be better than the featured film, so it's a win-win. I have watched it before. I grew up at the tail end of the time of the horror show hosts, when everybody had a, you know, Friday night Tales of Terror or, you know, whatever. And so I've seen a lot of those guys before. And he is one of the survivors that's still around. It's, you know, it's kind of like watching Joe Bob Briggs on Shudder, who used to be on various channels. It is fun. It is fun to watch. For the show, will you do a season about Colorado, Denver, or will you be in the area? And we may be in the area. I don't know. I will probably at some point, I'm sure, if we haven't already, feature some stuff from Colorado as far as, you know, stories that of things that have taken place there. I can foresee that coming at some point in the future. We'll see. In fact, maybe even this season, but I don't want to spoil anything. So, I don't know. It's hard to say. I don't know that we'd ever have strictly a Colorado season, but I mean, you just never know. And then this is the question for Cody. Cody, are you single? That's the question. And then she says, just joking, but you know, many truths are off spoken in jest. But she said, I had to throw that in there. So I will leave that up to Cody to decide whether he wants to answer it or not. But Thanks, Mary Beth, for the text.
Got it. Well, my answer would be I learned that Paul Thomas Anderson's father was one of those Svengoli type guys, I believe. That's what I heard it on a podcast the other day. So anyway, thank you very much for your kind
message.
All right.
So there's really that question. There's the answer to your question. So this is this one is coming to us from the 509. And this is listening to the murder of Nell Cropsey. And question for you regarding stickers. Did we talk about stickers? We must have. Do you sell them online? Would you ever consider selling them online? We're actually working on some deluxe stickers, believe it or not, that we might sell online. Normally, we do give them away.
Yeah.
They're normally free. Every once in a while, we still get, whenever anybody orders anything, we send out stickers. Mm-hmm. If you visit the museum, you can pick up stickers for free or any of our events. We do send them out with orders, and we're hoping to get some deluxe ones going here sometime soon, hopefully during the Halloween season. It says, thanks for all you guys do. Still having issues with that. Oh, still having issues with that D pass. Just kidding. Yeah. Don't feel bad. I know you don't. I live around an area that has a lot of Indian names, and in my work, there's a lot of Latin words, and I can't say any of them at all. So, yeah. Yeah, well, we'll always have trouble with that, and we're no longer going to talk about it. So, yeah. Anyway, this one comes to us from Nicole in the 314. Says, longtime listener, first-time caller. She said, sorry, had to say that. My husband's an avid camper and backpacker, mostly in southern Missouri state parks, but occasionally other places in the U.S., and I was just asking him before he left for another week into the woods, do you ever get spooked while he's out there alone sleeping in a human burrito suspended from the trees? This prompted me to wonder if you, Troy, or Cody have ever encountered any creepy situations while in the outdoors, be it supernatural or not. Would love to hear any stories you have. As always, I love the pod, and I'm looking forward to spending the high holy season with American Hauntings podcast. She has another note. I'll save that for a second if you want to answer it. I actually did a book about the outdoors and ghost stories and haunted hikes and things, which needs updated. But I've had some weird experiences. It's spooky out there sometimes. Mm-hmm. If you sit down and watch the Blair Witch Project, you'll never go camping again, you know? So yeah, it could definitely get you creeped out while you're out there. And I write way too many, stories about people who disappeared and were never seen again while on a hiking trip. So yeah, it doesn't stop me from going sometimes, but yeah, it's still, yeah, I used to go a lot more than I do now, but
I've done a lot of camping mostly when I was younger. And then as I got older, we camped out outside some castle in Ireland, and we went for like a, midnight walk kind of thing. And didn't see anything. I don't think I've really ever run into anything or anything that probably just wasn't my mind playing tricks on me or me thinking about the Blair Witch kind of
but
thing.
But it sounds like a future season of the podcast.
Yeah, it could be
at some point down the road. So,
know. Good question.
So, but she said, special note, for a podcast that usually ends with, and her corpse was never found, your care in speaking out for the safety, health, and rights of women doesn't go unnoticed.
Oh, great.
Being rad. So yeah, we do try to do that. And so then I have one more. It's a short one. It's just from the 513. It says, what are your thoughts on the Tesla screens showing people walking around in cemeteries? So, well, my thoughts on it, I can't tell you absolutely for a fact. I don't know anything about Teslas. I do know that the guy who makes them is insane, or at least it runs the company. But other than that, I don't know. But I do remember when that came up a couple of years ago. I haven't seen much about it lately. But a couple of years ago, there were people driving through cemeteries and their Tesla screens, which are supposed to show people, were picking up people walking as they were driving through a cemetery. There were people that would show up on the screens walking. And it became kind of a viral thing online for a while. I think it's ghosts. I have no idea. I really don't. The only thing I have to judge it by is that, Teslas are not exactly, glitch free. I don't know. Is it possible? Hell, anything's possible, I suppose. But I don't know. I don't have a clear answer for you on that. I just think it's it's, I don't know watching the screens play, they didn't seem, I don't know. I thought they would be a lot more sophisticated than that. I'd never actually seen a Tesla screen. I have zero interest. I don't have much interest in cars, to be honest. And so, or Teslas. And so I just assumed that, you know, a car that in the future is supposed to be able to drive by itself, I thought the screen would be a lot more sophisticated than that. It kind of looks like the old screen that we used to have on like GPS units, the ones that, you know, were not part of your car or on your phone that you used to have, like a TomTom. Kind of what it looks like. And I thought, huh, you know, because when I first heard about it and I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, oh man, this could be something really cool because, you know, it's a Tesla, you know, surely those are fancy, right? And it's really just sort of like a step above those things where people have the screens that have the stick figures on them. And I don't really know what that is either.
I'm
kind of an Occam's razor kind of guy in a lot of cases. And, you know, what seems like the simplest answer, that's probably the one that's correct. And I would think it's a glitch, but I really don't know. So
yeah, I'm looking at this now, just looking at images of it. And it is interesting. I'll have to look into it a little bit more, but yeah, it's not stick figures, but it is just like, almost like the claymation type.
I know, like, right?
Bodies.
Right.
Yeah.
It does. It looks like an old TomTom screen.
Yeah.
That's when I looked at it, I thought, wow, I thought that would be fancier, but yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to watch some of these videos later just because now I'm just curious to kind of
see. Yeah, it is fun to watch. It is fun to look into, but yeah, I don't have a solid opinion on that. Sorry. I really don't.
So. No, that's a fun question though.
Yeah, absolutely. So, okay. Well, guys, I think we're going to wrap this up. Thanks for listening. Share the show with your friends, your neighbors, anyone you know. If you like the show, or even if you don't, leave us a review on iTunes anyway, or you could send us an email or drop us a text on the Haunt line at 217-791-7859. You can also check us out on social media. You can find Cody and I on Facebook, Instagram, and occasionally Twitter, which we refuse to call X. Also, don't forget, use the discount code podcast when shopping for books, tours, events, or whatever at AmericanHauntings.net. And you'll also find the link there for Cody's shirt store, American Hauntings Clothing. And you can use the same code there too. That code is podcast. That's all you got to put in. And you'll always get 10% off everything you order.
All righty. Well, this episode of the American Hauntings podcast was written and performed by Troy Taylor. And it was produced and edited by me, Cody Beck. To find out more about the show, check out our website at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com, which features show notes, links, and sometimes photos that go along with each episode.
And not a travel guide to New Orleans.
Not yet.
We'll get on that. So.
Yes, TBD. Soon. Thanks again for listening. We definitely wouldn't do it without you. So until next time, goodbye.
So long.
See you later. All right.
Well, we finished just in